Welcome to the Science Podcast for March 16th, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, new proposals for global governance, alcoholic fruit flies, and mental health in Indonesia. Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
As the June 2012 UN Conference on Sustainable Development rapidly approaches, the scientific community is gearing up to make the environment a global priority. A policy forum this week argues that the current practice of incrementally changing global environmental policy is no longer effective amid rapid climate change. Instead, Frank Biermann and colleagues propose a specific set of reforms to meet today's environmental challenges more efficiently while benefiting the entire globe. Biermann spoke with me about why he thinks reforms are necessary.
We know from the natural sciences that there are a number of core processes in the Earth system that are changing fundamentally. This is why natural scientists have coined this term of the Anthropocene that has been described as a fundamental transformation of key planetary systems. And we know what the demands are for the social systems and how to change current trends. But we also understand from our social science research that the social systems are not in the current condition to really change these trends. So the governance systems that we have, the international treaties, the national policies, they are all not effective enough of dealing with these challenges. And for this reason, we argue for a structural change in the global governance systems that are dealing with sustainable development and global environmental change. And we have laid out a number of propositions on how these systems of governance could be made more effective.
Can you give me a few examples of the challenges that you think are not being adequately met in today's system of governance?
Well, one is, for example, the speed of agreement. It takes a long time normally to get new agreements in place. One example is climate change, where the first framework convention has been negotiated in 1992. And since then, there is no change in the emission trends of major countries. I mean, the current state of global climate governance is surely not effective in dealing with the challenge of global warming that we see today. So therefore, one possibility could be to have qualified majority voting that gives also special right to the major countries, not necessarily majority voting with on a one country, one vote principle, but a system of voting where also the larger countries can protect their own interest in a more meaningful way. Well, we can talk about fragmentation, for example. One issue is the fragmentation of international environmental agreements. We have at present about 900 international agreements in force that are dealing with some aspects of the environment. But all of these agreements are very fragmented. There's not a coherent system of international environmental law that is kind of uniting all this. There are different norm-setting processes. The secretariats of all of these agreements are mostly hosted at different places. So this is one of the reasons that we need a structural change where we bring more coherence and more integration into this system of international environmental governance. And this also relates to the fragmentation between economic and environmental governance, where environmental governance is done in a distinct policy arena and distinct treaties, while economic governance, on the other hand, is done in the Bretton Woods organization, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, many other regional development banks. And also here, we need a much more coordination and coherence in these approaches between economic and environmental governance.
And so these recommendations that you've put forth all come from something called the Earth System Governance Project. So can you tell me a little bit about that?
Right. The Earth System Governance Project is a 10-year international research program that involves around 200 core researchers and about 1,000 other researchers that are involved in it. It is endorsed by a number of other research organizations, ICSU, International Social Science Council, and others. And it has started in 2009. And it is the main umbrella under which this assessment has been conducted. And the assessment itself has been conducted by 32 of the leading scholars in this field, political scientists, lawyers, sociologists, development study people, so an interdisciplinary international group of scholars within the framework of the Earth System Governance Project.
Okay. And so in this particular assessment, you've come up with 7 recommendations in particular. So can you just kind of sum up the reforms that you're recommending here?
Well, the core is, as I said, is that we believe that the incremental approaches that have been done in the last 10, 20 years in the international system are not enough. So we argue in favor of a structural change in global governance to deal with problems of global environmental change. Among others, we argue for the creation of a new council within the UN system, a council on sustainable development that should better integrate sustainable development challenges, the economic, the social, and the environmental pillars of sustainable development at the highest level in the UN system. We also argue for the upgrading of the existing UN Environment Program to a full-fledged specialized UN agencies, which would give this agency better possibilities, better mandate to influence norm-setting processes, a better source of funding, and a higher influence in international governance. We also argue for stronger consultative roles of civil society in the UN system or in global governance in general to increase the accountability and legitimacy of global governance. We also argue in favor of a stronger reliance of qualified majority voting in international decision-making. This is currently still very much based on the consensus principle, and we argue here that qualified majority voting can increase the speed of setting new standards and getting new regulations in place.
And now you also briefly mentioned the concept of accountability. Now, if you're moving so many of these guiding bodies to sort of a global scale, how can accountability be maintained?
Well, this is, of course, a great challenge, because if you have stronger global governance, stronger international institutions, then this might lead to a stronger role for national international bureaucracies. So the key question that we also have to ask ourselves is, how can we hold these global systems of governance accountable to citizens? I mean, how can we invent, in a way, democracy, accountability, legitimacy at the global level? Mm-hmm. And to achieve this, we have also a number of proposals. There should be a need to the disclose of information at the global level. Civil society organizations should gain more rights in getting information, in assessing information, and also a stronger right to be heard in international norm-setting procedures. So there are a number of proposals out there on the table. We have not reached a consensus yet on what the best methods would be to involve citizens at the global level, civil society organizations, in international decision-making processes. But we believe this is very important, and that this is certainly one of the research areas where we will continue our work.
So all of these ideas, all of these recommendations for reform, how do they move from being on this two-dimensional piece of paper to being actually discussed in a global forum?
Well, we believe that all of these ideas are somewhat reflected in parts of the political discussions already. We do not believe that any of these proposals will really be accepted in June this year in Rio de Janeiro. I think this would be very unrealistic. But on the other hand, there could be a possibility that governments agree at least on a roadmap, on a general decision that some of these ideas are worth exploring further, and then governments could set up negotiation committees and processes that could lead to the implementation of some of these proposals within 5, 10, or 15 years. This is certainly possible.
Hmm. So you're optimistic that at least the discussions will begin in Rio?
Well, the times are certainly very difficult for dealing with global environmental issues, given financial crisis, all other kind of political issues that are certainly much higher on the agenda. But on the other hand, the urgencies are there. The urgencies and changes in planetary systems, so we very much hope the governments get together the political will to enact a reform plan for global governance in this area in Rio de Janeiro this June, and that then in the next couple of years we would see some of the structural changes that we propose to be implemented.
Well, sounds like some very important topics of discussion. Frank Biermann, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Frank Biermann and colleagues write about global environmental governance in a policy forum this week. In an editorial this week, Maria Lepton, director of the European Molecular Biology Organization, discusses the economics of open access journals from the perspective of a scientist and publisher.
Open access is, of course, an excellent idea. It's wonderful to try and give everybody out there access to scientific results. The problem is that there are economic strings attached.
You can listen to more of the interview and read the editorial at www.sciencemag.org.
There are certain rewards in life for fruit flies. Food, sex, and even alcohol trigger a sense of satisfaction in tiny Drosophila. Ulrike Heberlein and colleagues are investigating the molecular basis of this simple reward system in an attempt to take on the much more complex problem of drug and alcohol addiction. I spoke with Heberlein about how to determine what fruit flies find rewarding and why.
Our original goal was to understand the molecular mechanisms by which experiences affect drug addiction. Now, it's well documented that environmental and psychosocial factors affect drug use and abuse in humans, and we have mostly focused on the genes and not these other factors. And so we started out by just seeing if we could reproduce this phenomenon in Drosophila. It seemed like a crazy idea at the time. These are flies, after all. But as the work unfolded, it became clear that these mechanisms that we were trying to get after were related to reward systems, and in particular, the interaction between natural rewards, such as sex, and drug reward, in this case, alcohol consumption. So we approached this by subjecting male flies to different sexual experiences and asked how this would affect voluntary alcohol consumption. And we found that sexual rejection increases alcohol consumption while mating reduces it. And we found that the mechanism underlying this experience-induced change in drinking is mediated by a neuropeptide called neuropeptide F, or MPF, which is the fly homologue of mammalian neuropeptide Y, or MPY.
Okay, well, let's start with the fruit fly. Why is this a good model to use in this type of research?
Well, certainly originally we had no reason to believe that they would be a good model. But some of the basic mechanisms that are involved in drug use and in drug reward are highly conserved in evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, can learn a lot from flies that can be extrapolated to mammals, including humans.
So let's talk about the experimental setup that you used. How did you determine that rejection was related to preference for alcohol?
So the way we did these experiments is we took one group of males and subjected them to chronic rejection by mated females on four consecutive days. I mean,
mm-hmm.
This is pretty drastic rejection. And another group of males was provided with virgin females, many of them, for the same 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
So they had very different experiences. And on day five, each group was introduced individually into vials that are fitted with capillaries that contain either liquid food or liquid food supplemented with 15% ethanol. And we can then measure the amount of the liquid consumed from these tubes over the next 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
And we can calculate the preference for ethanol versus regular food. And we found that the rejected males drink a lot more or have a higher preference for ethanol than the mated males.
And so there are a couple of other factors that might have had an effect on the fly's preference for alcohol. How did you eliminate alternatives like just not having sex versus having had sex?
Well, that's a good point. And that was probably one of the most difficult issues to resolve. Because as you say, males that are put through this courtship conditioning paradigm experience two things. They experience the physical rejection, which is quite brutal, I have to say, and they fail to copulate.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to discern these two factors, we exposed males to decapitated virgin females. These females don't allow copulation, but they do not reject the males.
So rejection is actually like a physical fighting off type thing?
Yeah, they run away, they extrude their ovipositor, they kick them. And so what we found is that when you train these males with decapitated virgins, which, as I said, do not reject them, obviously, but they don't allow copulation either, that the males showed drinking behavior similar as if they had been rejected. So that's high alcohol consumption. So we can therefore say that it's probably the failure to mate that is the important issue here, rather than being exposed to the social experience of being rejected.
Oh.
And we actually further solidified that issue by taking rejected males and dividing them into two groups. One group was left undisturbed, and the other group was allowed to mate for 2 hours mm-hmm. before put into the alcohol consumption assay. And just 2 hours of mating with virgin females completely reversed the effect of rejection on alcohol consumption. So these males reduced their alcohol consumption just by being allowed to mate.
So it was a rescue operation. They no longer sought out the alcohol. So you've eliminated these alternatives, but there needs to be kind of an explanation. Why would these flies seek alcohol if they were denied sex? What's the underlying mechanism here? You zeroed in on a neuropeptide that may explain on the biological level, right?
That's right. I have to say that this was really a very lucky, educated guess. So we searched for a molecule with two characteristics. First, that it is sensitive to social experience or the environment. And second, that it would regulate ethanol behavior. And the mammalian homologue of neuropeptide F, called neuropeptide Y or MPY, fit that bill. It had been described in the literature that MPY levels are low in certain conditions such as post-traumatic stress disorder and depression, and they're reduced by some stressful experiences in rodents. So essentially we guess that the fly homologue of MPY, MPF, might be the molecular link that functions to transduce experience into changes in ethanol preference.
So you looked at the levels of these proteins in different groups of the male flies, and you also did some genetic work. What were your main findings in those experiments?
Well, this turned out to be quite nice. So when we measured the levels of MPF expression in rejected, virgin, and mated males, mm-hmm. we found sort of a graded response. Rejected males had low levels of MPF compared to virgin males, and mated males had higher levels of MPF than virgin males. So there is this bidirectional regulation of MPF levels by sexual experience. So this essentially is a correlation. The real challenge was to determine whether there was a causal relationship mm-hmm. between experience-dependent changes in MPF levels and the drinking behavior of these flies. So that's when we resorted to the toolkit of Drosophila. So for example, mated males have high MPF levels. So what we did is we inhibited the MPF receptor in mated males. And if these high levels were causally related to the low level of drinking, if we inhibited the receptor, these flies should drink more. Mm-hmm. And indeed they did.
So they have higher levels, but they can't actually react to that higher level. So they continue to drink.
Exactly. And the converse experiment was to activate MPF neurons artificially, again, using genetic tools, in males that had not made it, which had lower MPF levels mm-hmm. and high levels of drinking. And what we found is that in these males, drinking was substantially reduced. So they behaved as if they had made it, although they hadn't.
So it sounds like you found your culprit on the molecular level. What are some of the broader implications of this type of research? I think you mentioned addiction at the beginning. So how can this apply to mammals or to people?
Well, I would say that there are sort of two important implications. One is more scientific, and which is that perhaps MPF and its mammalian homologue MPY may be sort of the currency of reward, modulated by negative and positive experiences and drive behaviors that would restore normal levels and therefore restore the reward system to a normal state. If you were able to elevate MPY levels in humans which have undergone negative social experiences, you could probably restore health. Mm-hmm. And it is actually known that subjects with depression, PTSD, and the brains of suicide victims have lower levels of MPY, although it is at this point not clear whether this is a cause or an effect. Regardless, because of MPY being such a major molecule involved in a variety of these complex behaviors, there are a variety of clinical trials going on mm-hmm. to deliver MPY directly, in the case of anxiety and PTSD and other mood disorders and actually obesity.
But is anyone looking at it in reference to sex or sexual behavior?
Not to my knowledge. So I would like to stress, though, that we use sex as a mechanism to expose the flies to opposing social experiences, and to opposing rewarding experiences.
Okay. Well, Ulrike, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Take care.
Ulrike Heberlein and colleagues write about sex, drugs, and fruit flies in a report this week.
The devastation following the 2004 earthquake and tsunami in the Indian Ocean was met with a massive worldwide humanitarian response. While short-term aid was the highest priority, the rush has resulted in a potentially long-term solution to a major problem in the developing world: insufficient care for the mentally ill. Science News writer Greg Miller visited Aceh Province, Indonesia, for this story.
In 2005-2006, I did a series of articles for Science on global mental health, and one of those articles had to do with the response to the tsunami in South Asia. And for that story, I went to Sri Lanka, and there was a huge outpouring of concern and financial aid that was geared towards the psychological health of the survivors. And it was actually in some ways too much of a good thing with all these groups coming in and just having varying levels of expertise and not knowing much about the culture or speaking the language. And it was kind of chaotic. And so there were sort of two things. I wanted to follow up on that and see what had happened, this time in a different area that was affected by the tsunami in Aceh, Indonesia. The other thing that's happened since I wrote that series of articles was that there seems to be kind of an increasing interest in global mental health. And for a long time, mental health kind of took the back seat to infectious disease like HIV, AIDS, and malaria, and tuberculosis in developing countries, which definitely kill more people than mental illness does. But mental illness is a huge source of disability and a barrier to economic development in developing countries. And for the most part, there are virtually no resources available. And so one possible solution is to shift some of the work to more abundant kinds of workers. And that's what the program in Aceh is trying to do.
Now, before the tsunami and everything that followed in 2004, what did traditional mental health care look like in Indonesia?
It was pretty typical of the situation in a lot of developing countries, where there might be one or two psychiatrists for every million people in the population, and the psychiatrists tend to be concentrated in the big cities at mental hospitals. And, you know, in Aceh in particular, it's a fairly rural province, and for people in the more remote parts, it might take them a full day over mountain roads that aren't paved to get to the hospital in the capital city. And in that part of the world, a lot of people don't necessarily think of mental illness as a medical condition the way we tend to in the West. In particular, with people who might have schizophrenia or a psychotic illness, a lot of families would turn first to traditional healers who would prescribe chanting and prayers and, in extreme cases, maybe even beat the patient with sticks or, you know, prod them with burning sticks to try to drive the spirits out. And that, you can imagine, isn't typically very effective. And so what people would often resort to if they had a seriously ill family member is to confine them. And I met one man there who was, I think, 41, and he'd spent almost 20 years in a cell that his family had built in the yard because he'd had a sort of violent outburst in his 20s. And that was really born not so much of, you know, cruelty or trying to punish him, but just that the family really felt that they had no other options. And there really weren't many options in Aceh before the tsunami for mental health care.
But then, as you said, with the tsunami came this turnaround in mental health care. So tell me about this new program that's been in place for a couple of years.
Right. So since about 2005, the provincial health authorities in Aceh have been organizing training for general practitioners and nurses at clinics throughout the province. And they bring in teams of psychiatrists and mental health nurses from various hospitals, universities, other institutions in Aceh and in other parts of Indonesia to do a few days of training to give those people some extra mental health care training. And then the other component of it is that the community mental health nurses have trained thousands of volunteers out in the villages, in the communities, So when the village volunteers see someone who might need help, they'll go get the nurses to come evaluate them, and the nurses can then take them to the clinic to see a doctor and get medication if they need it or get some basic counseling.
So how do Indonesians feel about this program? How are they responding to these volunteers wanting to talk about their psychological well-being much more than they had in the past?
Overall, it's really hard to know, but I definitely met people who said they'd been helped by the program and knew other people who had. In one village, the village leader told me that before the community mental health program started, there was a lot of stigma against mental illness in his village. And so if someone had a sick family member, the other villagers would not only avoid the sick person, but they would stop doing business with the family as well and just really avoid them and shun them. And now he says in the couple years since the nurses have been coming and some of the villagers have been trained as volunteers, that's not as much the case anymore, that when someone has a sick family member, the other villagers will try to help the family more and maybe find some kind of job that the patient can do to stay occupied and engaged and bring in a little money for the family.
So there's less of a stigma.
That's what he said.
Now, is there any sort of quality control that's going on? I mean, I can imagine if these volunteers were not necessarily treating patients properly, there could even be adverse effects.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And unfortunately, the program in Aceh doesn't have the funding to do any kind of detailed research or evaluation tracking the patients to see how well they fare in the long run. There are, though, a handful of clinical trials that have been done in other developing countries where people have used lay counselors to treat common kinds of mental illness. And the results from some of those studies actually look really promising, but there's a big question of whether you can scale it up to the level of a province or an entire country and have it work.
Right, right. So what does the future of this sort of program look like? Even though there may be some promising results in other countries, is this a long-term solution? Is it sustainable?
I think that's a great question, and it's a completely open question at this point. I think the issue of mental health in developing countries has for a long time really been kind of under the radar, and it's finally starting to get more attention, and I think a lot of people think that this type of approach, using more nurses and maybe village volunteers and giving general practitioners some extra training, is really the only viable option in developing countries to meet this huge unmet need. And this is something that the World Health Organization has been promoting and trying to encourage their member states to look into. But it's still early days, and I think the program in Aceh is kind of a big, messy, real-world experiment in whether this kind of approach can work. But in developing countries, it may be the only option.
And what about more developed countries? Are there any aspects of this program that we might be able to adopt here in the West?
It's an interesting possibility. I mean, obviously in the U.S., we have a huge national debate about skyrocketing healthcare costs. And one advantage of shifting some of the care from specialists like psychiatrists to nurses and other kinds of less specialized healthcare workers is that it is a potential way to save money on healthcare costs. So there is an interesting question here about whether some of these experiments that are kind of born in of necessity in developing countries could also benefit those of us fortunate enough to live in wealthier countries as well.
Greg Miller, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Greg Miller writes about mental health care in Indonesia in a News Focus this week. You can also view a slideshow of the patients and caregivers he met while visiting Indonesia on our website.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor for Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. Okay, David, let's start with the sound. What was that?
Well, Sarah, that sound is part of the triumph display of the male white flippered penguin. And this is a penguin that tends to get in a lot of fights, especially there's a colony in Flea Bay in New Zealand of these guys that are particularly aggressive. Some penguins in this colony are actually missing eyes to show you how much and how aggressively these guys fight. And when the winner wins the fight, they make that sound that you just played, and they do a bit of a dance too, complete with flipper waving. It's sort of the male penguins, the winner's way of saying, I'm victorious, I'm the man, I'm the boss, you better not fight me again.
So is that what scientists decided it actually means?
Well, scientists kind of know that that's what it means for the loser. When the victor makes this noise and makes this display, the loser, at least in other bird species, seems to be less likely to challenge that victor penguin again. What scientists didn't know is what effect all of this displaying has on the audience, because these fights tend to have an audience of male and female penguins. And the question was, do the spectators take anything away from the call as well as the loser does?
So how do they test how the bystanders felt about these champions' calls?
Well, sir, what they did was they actually took recordings of penguin fights and they stitched them together into fight sounds, and the fights sometimes ended with this braying call of the victor. Sometimes they ended with a call from the loser, which is not as sort of dramatic. And then they played these manufactured audio recordings to a group of 43 bystander penguins. And near these penguins, they actually placed these fake eggs, these infrared eggs that actually measured the penguins' heart rate, because they wanted to get a sense of how stressed out these bystander penguins would be when they heard these sounds. These speakers that were playing these sounds were about 5 meters away. After about 5 minutes, when the sounds were done, they moved the speakers to 2.5 meters away, so they were a lot closer to these penguins. And then they played the call of the winner or the loser. And the idea was to trick these bystanders into thinking that the winner or the loser was approaching. And what the researchers found was that both male and female bystanders got stressed out when they were listening to fights, with females similarly stressed out regardless of whether the winner or the loser approached their burrows after the fight. But males were much more stressed out if a winner rather than a loser approached their burrows, and they were much more likely to challenge a loser that was approaching than challenge a winner. And the fundamental conclusion is that when the victors make these sounds and these displays when they win, it's not only a signal to the loser, like, hey, you better not mess with me again. It's also sort of a signal to everybody in the crowd. It's like, hey, don't you even think about fighting with me, messing with me.
Right.
It's sort of a display that affects everyone.
So they're delaying maybe more fights that they might have ended up going into.
Exactly.
Very cool. Next, let's talk about an ancient mammal that survived the extinction of the dinosaurs but is no longer around today.
Well, Sarah, this is actually a group of creatures known as multituberculates, and these were mouse-sized, sometimes slightly larger mammals that first arose about 165 million years ago. And as you stated, they lasted a long time. They actually were around until about 34 million years ago, which means that they were around long after the dinosaurs went extinct, which was about 65 million years ago. The question is, how did they survive and how much did they sort of proliferate before they died out? And the only way researchers can really get at that mystery is to figure out what these animals were eating during their lifetime, which has really been sort of up in the air. Scientists have speculated that they munched on everything from grains to insects to even meteor prey, but nobody really knew for sure. And that's what, sort of what this new study is all about.
And so how did they look into something that happened so long ago?
Well, what they did was they looked at 48 fossils that represented 41 different groups of these multituberculates, and they looked at a subset of their teeth, actually their cheek teeth. They were looking for distinct surfaces on these teeth, which they refer to as facets. And the idea is that mammals with a low number of facets typically are meat eaters. And the reason is because they don't do a lot with their teeth. They just sort of like gnaw off a piece of flesh and swallow it, and they let their stomach do all the work. But creatures with a lot more facets on their teeth, a lot more bumps and grooves and things like that, they tend to eat a lot more plants and nuts and things that require a lot of chewing before they get digested. And so the idea would be to find out with these multituberculates, how did their teeth change over time? And what researchers found is that a long, long time ago, when the multituberculates first arose, their teeth didn't have a lot of these facets, which means that they were probably eating a lot of meet. But as the group evolved over time, a lot more of its members started to develop much more complicated teeth with a lot more of these grooves and other facets in them. And by the time the dinosaurs went extinct, these multituberculates were already, according to their teeth at least, a lot of them were full-blown herbivores, which means they were eating a mixed diet dominated by plants rather than feasting on insects or other small, meaty prey.
So is there anything else besides the extinction of the dinosaurs that may have something to do with this expansion in their diet?
Well, so one of the big going hypotheses about the extinction of the dinosaurs is that mammals really weren't doing a lot while the dinosaurs were around. Mammals were really small. They sort of hung out in the background. They weren't diversifying. They weren't proliferating because the dinosaurs were basically just dominating everything. And then all of a sudden, when the dinosaurs went extinct, now we could have this explosion of mammals where mammals start getting bigger and diversifying on all this other stuff. Well, what this study suggests is that even before the dinosaurs kicked the bucket, multituberculates were already starting to diversify. And the reason might be because around the time that they were starting to diversify also coincided with an explosion in flowering plants known as angiosperms. And these were plants that were really themselves diversifying into a lot of different forms, trees, herbaceous plants. And the idea would be to take advantage of that, these multituberculates would have diversified to feed on them, which would have required developing much more complicated teeth, which means that this group was really undergoing an explosion. They didn't have to wait for the dinosaurs to die out. They already had sort of a spark to cause them to sort of diversify.
So they survived the dinosaur extinction and they diversified quite a bit, but then they didn't survive to modern times. What do the scientists think happened?
Well, that's a great question. You know, they mysteriously disappeared about 34 million years ago, even though they had really diversified. And nobody really knows the answer, but one expert we quote in the article says that it's possible that they were outcompeted by other creatures, rodents, primates, other mammals, all the other mammals that were really starting to come into their own around 30 million years ago or so, really drove these guys out of the equation.
Interesting. Last up, we have a story on how corals may be more adaptive than thought when it comes to global warming.
That's right. Sarah, you know, when we think about global warming, one of the big visuals that is evidence of the devastating impacts of a warming Earth is something called coral bleaching. This is when corals, which are typically very colorful underwater, turn white, essentially, and die soon afterwards. And the reason is because corals rely on symbiotic algae, and these algae not only give them their color, but actually produce nutrients that the corals need to survive. But when the waters get too warm, it upsets this delicate and symbiotic balance, and the corals expel the algae, they turn white, and they eventually die because they're not getting their nutrients anymore. And researchers have seen this in waters that are warming around the world.
So warmer water can really harm these corals. That sounds like bad news.
Well, Sarah, what this new study is finding is basically that it may not all be bad news for corals. That sometimes they can recover from these bleaching events. What the study entails is researchers looked at a 2010 bleaching episode. They looked at three different coral reef sites, all that suffered from bleaching in 2010. One was in Indonesia, and what was interesting about this site, the researchers hadn't recorded a bleaching event here previously, and the corals here did very poorly. There was a fast-growing coral known as Acropora, which just suffered massive die-offs. But what was interesting is the researchers looked at a couple other sites, one in Singapore and one in Malaysia, that also had this fast-growing Acropora species. And this time, Acropora seemed to be doing very well, despite the bleaching event. And what was different about this site was this site had also suffered a bleaching event in 1998. And the idea would be that Acropora, maybe because it's so fast-growing, may have evolved some sort of resistance to bleaching, or perhaps just due to natural selection, the strongest Acropora from the bleaching event in 1998 survived, and they were just much hardier when the water warmed again, and they did not die off in such large numbers. So this is a kind of a preliminary study. It's just based on a few locations. But what it suggests is that some coral may not be as susceptible to bleaching events as previously thought, and some of these reefs, which are really important for marine diversity, which is why we care about the bleaching of these coral reefs in the first place, may be able to survive global warming better than thought. Now, it's still, on balance, bad news, but there is a little bit of hope here.
So it seems that it's an open question about how big of an impact global warming will have on corals.
Exactly.
All right. So what else did you have on the news site this week?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about how an HIV drug may help protect against malaria. Also a story about why giant squid have such giant eyes. Their eyes are actually the size of soccer balls. We'll tell you why that is. For Science Insider, we've got a story about how animal rights activists have impacted ferry service from the UK to the rest of Europe. Also a story about why more than 100 organizations are calling for a moratorium on synthetic biology. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is on the ecological impact of climate change on the seasons. Why do seasons appear to be arriving earlier and earlier? Be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the March 16th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.